Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 50 years ago, almost to the minute, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Today, we look back on the events of that day through the eyes of key people on the scene in Dallas. They include the Secret Service agent who leaped into the president's limousine after the shots rang out, and a Kansas City, Kansas native who, as a surgeon, tried vainly to save the president's life at Parkland Hospital. We'll also speak to a UMKC professor who's on the scene this morning in Dealey Plaza in Dallas. We begin, though, with some sounds from 50 years ago, news reports compiled by United Press International in an album called 4 Days That Shocked the World.
Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. We're on the road to Parkland at this time. The Secret Service man is still spread eagle over whoever is in the car, the President and Mrs. Kennedy, and as we understand, Governor and Mrs. Connolly. At this point, it looks as though it could have been one or two or even all of the people within the car may have been the victims, may have been struck by shots. We don't know.
As he went by the Texas School Book Depository, headed for the Triple Underpass, there were 3 loud, reverberating explosions. Nobody moved. Everyone seemed stunned. A few seemed to look around, wondering who has the firecrackers. Then suddenly, the Secret Service men sprang into action. The convertible bearing the President and Mrs. Kennedy sped away, and officers, both plainclothes and uniformed, seemed to spring from everywhere at once, guns drawn, ordering people to lie flat. There are 2 witnesses who were near the president's car at the time of the explosions who say that shots were fired. From which upper window, we do not know. We do not and cannot confirm the reports at this time that the president has been shot. One witness says he definitely was shot, that he was hit twice, that he saw the president slump in his seat. As I say, this is not confirmed at this time.
And just now we've received reports here at Parkland that Governor Connolly was shot in the upper left chest, and the first unconfirmed reports say the president was hit in the head. That's an unconfirmed report that the president was hit in the head. The president's wife, Jackie Kennedy, was not hurt. She walked into the hospital at her husband's stretcher side. And a Dallas newsman, Mel Couch, said he was riding shortly behind the president in the parade. He said after the shots were fired, he happened to look up at about the 5th or 6th floor of the Texas Book Depository. He said he saw the rifle being pulled back in.
Now my conversation with Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who was described in that news report as the agent who was spread eagle over the back of the president's limousine after shots rang out in Dallas. Agent Hill didn't get there in time, and he viewed that as a personal failure that he's never moved past. Clint Hill has really spoken about the events of that day when he came into our studios in April 2012 for one of the most riveting interviews in my 11 years here. November 1963, how hard is it for you to talk about the events of that day?
It's emotional to talk about the events of that day, but it's cathartic at the same time.
Have you been back to Dallas yourself since that day?
I went back in 1990, and I walked
to Dealey Plaza.
To Dealey Plaza, walked the street there, Elm Street, Houston Street, went up into the 6th floor to Texas School Book Depository.
There's a museum there now.
Yeah. Yes, now called the 6th Floor Museum. Mm-hmm. I went up to the 6th floor, looked out that window, and I came away considering the weather, the angle, everything that happened that day. I came away realizing the shooter had all the advantages. We didn't have any that day, and that I did the most that I could have done given all the circumstances. And it was helpful to me, but it still didn't relieve that sense of guilt and responsibility.
That sense of guilt, I mean, you suffered from depression in the wake of what happened that day, and you were forced to really sort of move on with your life very, very quickly. You know, I'm wondering, you blamed yourself why, Clint, at least for a while?
Because I was the only agent in a position to do anything. The way everything developed, I was on the left-hand side of the follow-up car, which is the car immediately behind the president's. When the shots came from the right rear,
right,
behind the motorcade, I had been looking to my left. And when that happened, I looked toward where the shots came from. In the process, my vision took me across the back of the president's car. So I saw the president grab his throat, move to his left. I knew something had happened, that he was in trouble, and so I jumped and ran. Now, none of the other agents had that opportunity because when they looked toward the shots, they were looking away from the car. Mm-hmm. So they didn't see his reaction. They didn't realize that he had immediately been hit. I did, and so I ran, trying to get up on top of the car to place myself behind President and Mrs. Kennedy and lay there and form a shield between them and whoever was trying to do them harm.
You know, Clint, he had been very clear in the weeks preceding the events of that day. He did not want agents standing on the back of the car, back by the trunk. Mm-hmm. There's a little stand you could have, in theory, could have stood there. He didn't want you there. Why?
Because it appeared that there was somebody between him and the people. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want that to be the case. He wanted the people to feel that he was accessible all the time. He didn't want any agents hovering over him, causing him to feel that he was not accessible.
So the shots rang out, you make a rush for the car, and you barely got to the back of the car before the driver accelerated to take off to protect the president and get away from a very bad situation. Tell us how you managed to climb on the back of that car. I know how hard it was on you to keep your position on that car.
I did. I slipped because, like you say, the driver accelerated just as I got to the car. I slipped and had to take a couple more steps, and then I lunged forward. There's a handhold up on top of the trunk. Grabbed that and pulled myself up. About that time, Mrs. Kennedy came out of the trunk because some material had come off the president's head from the shooting and gone off to the right rear. She was trying to retrieve it.
And for an instant, you thought, this woman is going to go flying off the back of this car.
Well, I was afraid that would have been the case. And if I hadn't been there, she may very well have done that. The people in the follow-up car said that they could never have stopped had she come off the back of the car. They would have just driven over her.
So you're leaping on the back of that car. You're trying to maintain a hold for yourself there as the car accelerates. And you're also having to sort of push her and maneuver her back down into the back seat of the limousine.
Yes, I got a hold of her and pushed her back into the seat. Got myself up on top of the back rear of the back seat and wedged myself between the right side of the car and the left side of the car. And we traveled from the impact point to Parkland Hospital. We ran up to as close as 80 miles an hour.
And even then, you're hanging on.
I was hanging on. My sunglasses blew off. Yeah. So we finally did get to the hospital.
There's so many poignant moments here. There's a very poignant moment when you reach the hospital and other Secret Service agents come up to the car and recognize the situation. I think you write they're immediately reassigned to Vice President Johnson, who's about to become president. There wasn't much doubt in the eyes of some of your colleagues. But then for a moment, it was time to move Jack Kennedy into the hospital, and Mrs. Kennedy didn't want to let him go. What did you do?
Well, she did not want to let go of the president's body. And I finally recognized that the reason was she didn't want anybody to see the condition he was in. It was very, very bad, very gory. And so I took my jacket off and laid it over his head and his upper back. And when I did that, she let go. And so then we lifted him up, put him on a gurney, and took him into the emergency room.
Did you ever have any hope in your own mind that maybe he could be saved?
No, I did not, not personally. Everybody else, I think she did, but I did not.
What did you do next?
We got into the emergency room, and the doctors worked feverishly to try and revive him. Mrs. Kennedy stayed near the emergency room. My supervisor asked me to contact the White House in Washington. So I called the Dallas switchboard, which was the Dallas White House switchboard, and they put me through to the White House in Washington. And I was talking to my supervisor, Gerald Bain, and about that time the operator cut in and said, Mr. Hill, Attorney General Kennedy wants to talk to you. That was the president's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yes, Mr. Attorney General. He said, Clint, he said, what's going on down there? And I told him that the president had been shot. The governor had been shot, and we were in the emergency room at Parkland Hospital. And so he didn't recognize immediately the seriousness of the situation.
And did you explain it to him?
Well, he said, how bad is it? I did not want to tell him that his brother was dead. So I simply said, it's as bad as it can get. And with that, he hung up the phone And that's how he actually found out his brother had been killed.
Those are actually pretty sensitive words at a moment like that. You're conveying the information pretty clearly, but you're conveying it in a way that maybe he could handle it.
Well, I just couldn't see myself telling him point blank that the president had died. But obviously he got the message.
You know, the events of that day, Clint, how clearly do you recall them even now, nearly 50 years later? Is it as clear in your mind today as it was when it happened that day?
Yes, it is, very much so.
You can see it all?
Yes, I can, unfortunately.
You know, on the plane going back to Washington, obviously such a somber flight with the president's body, you know, in the plane. How did Mrs. Kennedy bear up during the course of that long flight?
She held up very well. She stayed in the rear of the aircraft where the casket was, where we had placed the casket. At one point, after we found out that Vice President Johnson had to be sworn in there in Dallas on the ground, we had to arrange for a federal judge to do that. And she was asked to participate in that swearing in. And that is the photograph you see of she standing by the then Vice President as he's sworn in to replace her husband. Hmm. But she was very stoic through the entire thing and remained that way. She did call for me at one point, and she simply stood up and reached out her hand and said, "Oh, what's going to happen to you now, Mr. Hill?" And I simply said, "I'll be okay, Mrs. Kennedy. I'll be okay." But it is an indication of her concern for those of us, the agents who had been around, she and the president.
Even at a moment like that?
Yes, she was always concerned about others.
There was a moment, Clint, at the funeral when young John Kennedy saluted the casket. You know, it's been memorialized so many times, that famous photograph. There's been a lot of controversy over the years, as you know, about whether he was shielding his eyes from the sun or was he truly saluting. You answer that question in the book very clearly. What is the story there?
Well, in early November, Mrs. Kennedy came to us and asked to teach John how to salute. On the day, one of the days of the funeral, he got a little rambunctious, so the agents took him to an anteroom. And while in there, they started to keep him busy by having him practice his salute. And he kept on doing it with the left hand. There was a Marine Corps colonel standing in the doorway watching. And he saw this, and he came walking in, shaking his head, and simply said, "John, you've got it all wrong." And he showed him the proper way for a Marine to salute. And I'll be darned, John didn't do that, and he learned quickly. And on that day at St. Matthew's on the steps on November 25th, which was John's third birthday and the day of his father's funeral, he saluted his father as his casket left St. Matthew's Cathedral.
Hey, Clint, how many years did it take to convince you that you weren't responsible? When were you able to sort of move past that?
I've never completely moved past it. Somewhat, but it's taken a long time. I got better after the 1990 visit to Dallas, and this book, Reliving the Events of the Past, with the help of Lisa McCubbin, mm-hmm. has helped me really emotionally kind of climb out of that dungeon I was in.
That's former Secret Service agent Clint Hill. We sat down with him in April 2012 to talk about his book, Mrs. Kennedy and Me. Well, after the shooting, the action quickly moved from Dealey Plaza to Parkland Hospital.
President Kennedy has been given a blood transfusion at Parkland Hospital here in Dallas in an effort to save his life after he and Governor John Conley of Texas were shot in an assassination attempt in downtown Dallas. A priest has been ordered, emergency supplies of blood also being rushed to the hospital.
And now we turn to Dr. Kenneth Salyer, who got his MD degree at KU and was a resident at Parkland Hospital on the day the president was shot. Dr. Salyer established the International Craniofacial Institute in Dallas in 1986, and he's an adjunct professor in the Department of Orthodontics and the Department of Biomedical Sciences at the Baylor School of Dentistry. In 1964, he testified before the President's Commission on the assassination of President Kennedy. Well, Dr. Salyer, thank you for taking some time with us.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you very much.
I'm wondering what it must have been like as a young doctor to walk into the emergency room that day in Parkland to find the President of the United States lying there in very critical condition.
I was on neurosurgery call and was upstairs when a nurse came in and said the president's been shot. I ran down to trauma room number one, and I was preceded by two of my colleagues, one Jim Carrico and the other one Malcolm Perry, and he was one of our mentors, a young mentor. And they were trying to get a tube in the president. The president was there with a massive wound of the right side of his head and moving air through a wound in his neck. We tried to get a tube down through his into his trachea from there and couldn't, and then expanded the wound in his neck and got control of his airway and proceeded on to resuscitate him. But at the time I was doing it, I was just doing what I'd been taught to do and going through every possible thing to try and save his life. That was what we were there for. And it didn't really hit me, you know, and really sink in until after we pronounced him about 30 minutes later.
I was going to say, there wasn't a moment during the course of that chaos where you thought to yourself, you know, my goodness, I'm sitting here working on the President of the United States.
That moment came, and by the way, it wasn't chaos. It was well organized. It's not like a couple of the scenes I've seen in a couple of the film I've seen, like the JFK movie, or recently there was
Parkland, right?
Parkland, yeah. It wasn't like that. Jacqueline Kennedy was not crying. She was not hysterical. She was not saying a word. She was silent. She was probably in shock. She didn't have running mascara. She was perfectly composed, but, you know, was totally distraught by the whole situation.
So when you walked into the emergency room that afternoon, you knew the person awaiting you inside those doors was the president.
That is right. I knew that it was the president, and obviously it was a great moment, and it was a challenging moment to be thinking that the hero that I'd voted for in 1960 over Richard Nixon was there now, and he really was my hero. I really was taken with his charisma, his energy, his spirit, and the hope for the future for the whole country.
Again, I just can't help but think and put myself in your shoes, Doctor. You were a young man, 27 years old, I think.
I was a confident 27-year-old and had already had, I went to Parkland to get good hands-on experience. And over the year and a half before I saw the president, I had treated really literally hundreds of patients with major wounds. So it was very comfortable for me. And you just go into the doctor mode and you do what you need to do. And I was there with some of my colleagues. And I think it was, by the way, it was well organized. I felt like we did absolutely everything that could ever have been done. And he was in the right place if he was going to have resuscitation. The problem was he had a lethal injury of his head.
Mm-hmm.
The second shot that hit him was devastating, was lethal.
How quickly, Doctor, did you come to the conclusion that you weren't going to be able to save this man?
Not until we'd worked on him for about 30 minutes. Not until we had put in chest tubes, we put in IVs, we gave him external cardiac massage. I switched off with Dr. Carrico and myself, did that for the full 30 minutes. And it wasn't until we finally stopped and we had a straight line on the EKG and there was no effort about breathing that we finally agreed, all of the doctors that were there agreed that, okay, we're going to pronounce him. But it wasn't until that moment.
Was there ever any sense of hope?
I mean, I think for a physician or a surgeon, there's always a sense that there's always hope. But you know, an assessment, a significant assessment would tell me it's beyond what we can do, but we still need to give it everything we had. And I've been asked the question, well, what if he came in today, 50 years later, with this advancements in technology? And the answer would still be, no, we couldn't save him today because of that massive injury. He had lost a large piece of his skull. And brain was open, and it was really a devastating explosion out the right side of his head that literally threw blood all over the witnesses that were along the car and on all along Jacqueline Kennedy's strawberry pink suit. And she was looking, she was in the emergency room the whole time, was standing over in the corner, slumped down once. And then after we pronounced him, she came over and I looked at her. She looked at me. I didn't say a word. My chief had already talked to her, Kemp Clark. But she came over, leaned over his chest, and I witnessed a ring ceremony where she took off a ring, put it on his finger, and took one off of his finger and put it on her own. And then she sort of turned his farewell and was just stood there. They brought in a casket, and she stayed right with the casket from then on. And that was quite a moving moment. I think we both were in shock, and I remained in the room till everyone had left. The Catholic priest had come in right after that ceremony and had given him the last rites of the church, and that was it.
You know, Doctor, you just took the next question out of my hand, that moment that Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, sort of memorialized, the moment where she took the ring off her finger and put it in his hand. What else do you recall from that moment?
Well, I think what came about as a result of that moment is that I was determined to carry on in the spirit and the vigor and the method of which Kennedy demonstrated to me. He was a hero, and he had told us we need to take care of our children and the children of the world, and had started the peace, initiated the Peace Corps. He was taking us to the moon, and so I thought I wanted to at least carry on in the spirit of Kennedy, and I went on to develop a new specialty for children. It's called craniofacial surgery, and it's taken me all over the world, and I've treated patients here in Dallas in a premier center that I developed and treated patients from 75 countries in every state in the U.S. So it's been quite a wonderful career, and I think it was launched that day for me to be determined to lead a life and live every moment and make it count. You know, we as physicians or surgeons realize how thin the line is between life and death. But that day, that moment, I realized it was really, life is very delicate and fragile. Because my hero was gone, and it was almost like, he can't die, he can't leave, we can't lose him. You know, Doctor,
in the moment after which the president was pronounced dead, at that point, were there tears in that room?
There were not tears in that room at that moment. There were lots of tears after, but it's almost like, you know, we're still in the mold of the doctor at the moment. And when you're in that mold, you're not crying. But I've cried over many patients in my life and sat with families and cried. And I think later at home, for the next 3 days with the ceremony and the burial and the so forth, why I had plenty of tears. But Jacqueline had no tears while I observed her in that room. Neither did I.
Do you remember seeing the incoming president, Vice President Johnson?
No, I don't. He was not around in that. He was not in trauma room number one. Across the hall in trauma room number two, they were taking care of Governor Connally, who had been shot all the way through his chest, his right wrist, and his left thigh, and they were getting him ready, and he was taken to the operating room and explored and taken care of by Dr. Shaw, the head of thoracic surgery, but I was not involved in that.
There was also a dispute that day, a very angry dispute between the local coroner and the president's staff about whether the president's body could be taken, you know, from the hospital and returned to Air Force One for the flight back to Washington. What do you recall about that exchange?
I was left in the room, in trauma room number one. Everyone else had departed. And at the door, as they were going past the door, I heard a lot of heated back and forth discussion. And the coroner said, it's the state law. He has to stay here. And the Secret Service simply said, we're taking him. And they just lifted the casket up and just went on. That was it. And they headed straight to Love Field and back to Washington, D.C.
Was there anything surreal about that experience, you know, walking into a room to find the First Lady of the United States and her husband mortally wounded lying in front of you? Again, trying to put myself in the position of a 27-year-old resident at Parkland Hospital that day.
I think that's a good question, and I really, if I want to really take that, I would say yes, there is something surreal about having the First Lady and the President there and in the situation they're in. It's almost like, am I really here doing this? I can't believe that it's real. But yes, there is certainly that feeling. And I've never discussed that before, but you asked the question, and it's a good one.
Do you recall what you did the rest of that afternoon?
Well, I did. I did my rounds on the floor and the neurosurgery floor at that time and saw the patients. And I was then off for that weekend, and I was home glued to the TV and was not involved in any of the care of subsequently of Lee Harvey Oswald. But I was watching TV exactly the moment and saw him shot in the abdomen as they were bringing him through the basement of the
police station there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
But you didn't work on him in the hospital.
I didn't work on him, but we discussed, you know, and we had our weekly conferences, and I remember he was operated on by the chief of surgery, who was my chief, G. Tom Shires, who flew back hearing that the president had been shot. I think he was in Galveston at a meeting. And he was there in time for Lee Harvey Oswald. And I explored him, and the bullet went in the abdomen. And I remember it just like went around and around, and it just totally devastated a lot of organs. And they just couldn't really correct that problem either. It was another lethal shot.
So I'm wondering today, you know, on this 50th anniversary, you know, some 35, 40 minutes from now, what will you do?
Well, first of all, we are having in Dallas here a memorial ceremony, and I will be there, and we'll be thinking of that day. I do see still the president with that injury when I visualize him, but I will be thinking that maybe now, finally, Dallas, who has been themselves have felt guilty, realize that, you know, It could have happened anywhere. It did happen in Dallas, and left a big dark mark on Dallas for a long, long time. But maybe now at 50 years we can get over that, and the people here know that they're full of love and caring and warmth, and certainly not radical people like there may have been 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't aware of it.
Dr. Kenneth Salyer is a he was born in Kansas City, Kansas. He got a pair of degrees from the University of Kansas. He was a resident at Parkland Hospital 50 years ago today when President Kennedy was shot. Dr. Salyer, such a pleasure. Thank you for taking some time with us today.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you and your audience. I appreciate it very much. It's nice to feel back at home.
Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk with a KU history professor about why conspiracy theories about JFK's assassination persist to this day. And we'll also talk with a film professor about the one movie that he thinks best depicts the events of November 22nd, 1963. In our second half, we'd also like to hear your memories of that day, or maybe the memories of your parents. Give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can also post a memory on KCUR's Facebook page. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Conspiracy theories have dogged the Kennedy assassination from almost the minute that shots rang out in Dallas. Well, it turns out that conspiracy thinking has been as American as apple pie since before the Republic was founded and is one of the major hallmarks of our politics. KU professor Jonathan Earle teaches a history class titled Conspiracy Theories and Paranoia in U.S. History, and he joins us now. And Jonathan, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on with this great lineup, Steve.
What do you mean exactly when you say that conspiracy thinking is as American as apple pie, Jonathan?
Well, even before we were a new nation, the colonial Europeans who settled these shores kind of came with some really conspiratorial ideas that they were building a city on a hill, that their success would be looked and judged from the world over. And it makes things like, I don't know, a crop failure or an Indian attack seem almost providential.
Huh.
And then, you know, when you get to the Revolutionary era, both our patriots, our founders, were incredibly paranoid that Parliament was trying to take away their rights as Englishmen. At the same time, in Parliament in England, they were convinced in a paranoid way that our founding fathers wanted to break off and form an independent country. And it just gets going from there.
What's behind that, do you think? I mean, what drives so many people to believe in these conspiracies? You know, many of these conspiracies are as far-fetched, it seems to me, as 75-degree weather today, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, some of them are. Some of them are. I do think when you kind of start a country based on the idea that you are striking out in a brand new, original, almost unique trajectory, that you start to look at things that don't go the way they're supposed to go as sinister, and it must be designing men who are causing, you know, the failure of the economy, or that Jewish bankers or Catholics or anarchists. There's always somebody to blame, and it only got kind of more intense after the assassination of President Kennedy that we've been talking about today.
You know, so many conspiracy theories are attached to the Kennedy assassination. I mean, here's one, the magic bullet theory. Which one was that?
Sure. Well, the magic bullet theory was an attempt to explain how one bullet fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository could both injure President Kennedy, it was the one that came through his neck, then injured Governor John Connally of Texas sitting in front of him in the limousine. And if you watch the movie JFK, which I'm pretty sure we're going to hear about from Mitch Bryan next, you have to kind of do some backflips to figure out how one shot from that sniper's nest could do all that damage. The fact of the matter is, people have looked at that so many times, and if you put Governor Connally in a jump seat a little bit lower and a little bit to the left of the president, it's actually a pretty straight shot. But the idea of the magic bullet theory is a cornerstone of a lot of the conspiracies, proving there must have been a second shooter.
We're visiting with KU Professor Jonathan Earle about conspiracy theories. There's another theory that has gained a lot of traction over the years, the second shooter from the grassy knoll.
Sure. A lot of that, you know, if you remember back to the JFK movie, or if you read any of these books like Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Kennedy, they say, I've seen the Zapruder film, that Kodachrome minute-by-minute, frame-by-frame of the assassination, and when the president's head, you know, goes back into the left, that suggests that he was shot from the front. Now, again, I'm not a ballistics expert, but the ones that I've read and that I believe say that can actually happen if you're shot from the back of the head because of nerves and because of the way the human reflex works. But a lot of people saw that film, actually almost everybody has seen that film, and said, how could that shot have come from where Oswald was? And so that's why we always have looked for a second shooter coming from in front of the limousine on the so-called grassy knoll.
So where do you come down on all this, Jonathan? You spend a lot of time looking at all this stuff. I mean, did Oswald act alone or did he not?
Okay, that's a good question. I actually don't tell my students that, so I hope none of them are listening, are listening now. I think if you take the preponderance of evidence, and there is so much evidence, Steve, there are hundreds of thousands of pages of eyewitness testimony and footnotes and reports. I think Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, and I think he was the only one doing it. If you believe the opposite, you're ignoring, I would say, 80% of the evidence in favor of 20% of the evidence.
You know, it's amazing to me, Jonathan, how much we still care about all this. I mean, it's exactly 50 years since this event happened, and people are still poring over the minutes and the notes and the books and the transcripts, trying to figure the whole thing out.
Exactly, and they probably never will. I mean, we've tried. I think part of it is because the Warren Commission report was so over the top in its attempt to make closure,
yeah,
to shut this whole thing down, and it reads like a prosecutor's brief, and it bullies rather than persuades. So I can understand why, you know, good ordinary and educated people reading the Warren Commission report would say that doesn't answer any of the big questions that I have about this. So it just, you know, it's off to the races after the Warren Commission report is released in the fall of 1964.
know, you mentioned Oliver Stone's film JFK. I was surprised to take a look online at that film. It was made and came out in 1991. It only seems like yesterday to me. But
it's so true. Most of my students were born after that movie came out.
There you go. Well, that film...
you're right. They still know. They
yeah.
still know everything about it.
That film obviously reopened all this conspiracy thinking. What do you make of Oliver Stone and the movie that he made back in 1991?
Good question. I think Oliver Stone is a really brilliant filmmaker. The way he uses music and good dialogue and blends real life, you know, footage with things that he shot on a soundstage. But he's a terrible historian, Steve. He creates characters that didn't exist. He eliminates people that don't agree with his point of view, and you're left after that movie feeling kind of exhausted and just knowing that this nation's prosperous and peaceful future was robbed from us by these evil conspirators. And it's not good for our republic.
Well, that's the problem with some of these movies. I just saw Parkland, you know, a few weeks ago. I thought it was a terrific film. But again, you sort of walk out the door from seeing a film like that, and you don't know quite what to believe, which parts were true, which weren't. Dr. Salyer, we just had him on in our first half,
right,
describing the events of that day. He described the emergency room as tranquil. People, no chaos, no panic. People just very calmly and methodically going about their duties. And yet you see Parkland, which seemed like a straight-ahead kind of movie, and you saw something very different.
It's true. And there are some very good movies, by the way, that I hope we hear from Mitch about the JFK assassination or that touch on it. But I do think with JFK, it's just as a teacher and as a scholar and as someone who wants people to be members of their society and be citizens and go out there and change things instead of just try to find some elusive conspiratorial truth that they'll never chase down, it really kind of makes me sad.
You
as much
John,
as I like the movie myself.
Again, we're visiting with Jonathan Earle, a KU professor. You know, you say, Jonathan, that conspiracy thinking has sort of evolved from mostly a far-right phenomenon pre-JFK. I'm referring to, you know, Joe McCarthy, to something that has occupied the left. I mean, what's happened there?
Well, I think what the JFK assassination does is it makes conspiracy thinking mainstream. You know, it was this hallmark of the Joe McCarthy, John Birch Society right before 1963. And now you have, you know, legions of people who believe, especially young people, who believe, say, that 9/11 was an inside job or that a missile hit the Pentagon. And these are conspiracy theories that are much more from the left, say, critical of the Bush administration than the right. And then you also have all these really entertaining kind of left-leaning movies like 3 Days of the Condor or Parallax View or The Conversation that kind of make this mistrust of the government, of the CIA, of the FBI, of centralized authority one of their hallmarks. And I find them very entertaining. But again, the JFK assassination seems to me to be that watershed moment where things just exploded.
And to just fast forward 50 years, I mean, conspiracy thinking today seems to be alive and well in the age of Obama with all these, you know, all these questions about birthers and truthers and healthcare death panels. What's fueling
you name
that?
It, well, I actually think in some ways we've kind of returned to Richard Hofstadter's original paranoid style model, where it is this far right wing that is very opposed to the things that are changing rapidly in American society. Things like having an African American president. Things like having gay marriage legal in 15 states in the District of Columbia. I think there really is a feeling among people on the right that things cannot have happened this way legitimately. The president couldn't have won his office legitimately. He couldn't have been born in the United States. He's masking his true religion and political beliefs. All of these things are classic conspiracy theory hallmarks.
KU professor Jonathan Earle teaches a history class titled Conspiracy Theories and Paranoia in U.S. History. And Jonathan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for taking some time.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great to talk to you, Steve.
Let's go to some phone calls now at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Susie from Liberty. Susie, what do you recall from your memories from this day 50 years ago?
Yes. In 1959, I was a college student in Salina, Kansas. And President Kennedy came to Marymount College, first Catholic presidential candidate, so of course he came to Marymount. Unbelievably charismatic. I actually met him. Secret Service was so lax at that time that I was able to go, as he was exiting, to the back of the stage and shake his hand. When he was killed, my husband was in the service. I knew about it, and I thought, wow, when I go to pick Bob up off the pier, either the ship will either be out to sea or they'll be on lockdown. Not so. I drove on the base. I drove to the end of the pier. Bob got in. We drove home. I filled him in on what happened. There was no shutdown. There was absolutely no military response at that point in time.
Susie, well, I'm glad you called. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
From Rebecca, I was a first grader in Peoria, Illinois, and our class was interrupted with the news. My teacher was very angry at the tragedy and the waste. That afternoon, I asked my mom, why would someone shoot President Kennedy? She looked at me a long time, teared up, and said simply, I don't know. We watched the funeral procession in class the following week. Our family had the Life and Time magazines memorializing JFK, and it was my first memory of current events. I'm glad our country is pausing to remember this tragedy. It was a precursor, perhaps, of other political assassinations later on that decade. Well, we're joined now by Mitch Bryan. He's one of our DVD gurus. Mitch is a screenwriter and a UMKC film professor, and he's going to talk about his favorite film that depicts the events of this day 50 years ago. Mitch, welcome. Good to have you.
How you doing, Steve? Nice to talk to you.
Tell us about the film that you've picked, a film that perhaps best depicts the events of this day 50 years ago.
Well, I chose sort of an unusual choice in the sense that, as we heard earlier, a film like Parkland clearly is inventing things. I think any time you're charged with trying to represent what really happened on film, all sorts of problems arise, you know? And so there's a movie from 1979 called Winter Kills, which is based on a novel by Bill Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate. And what it does is it attempts to look at the assassination and the possible conspiracy by dropping back and creating a fictional version of the Kennedys, who he calls the Keegan family. And what the story is really about is, in a way, it's addressing these conspiratorial ideas dramatically and fictionally, and especially examining the relationship between Kennedy and his father, in this case, Keegan and his father, Pa Keegan, who is modeled after Joseph Kennedy. And I think that what it does is it takes the collective myth, that all the possible enemies that might have been involved in this conspiracy, and dramatizes it in a darkly comic way. Jeff Bridges plays Nick Keegan, the youngest brother, who stumbles on to one of the identities of one of the assassins and begins to piece together the conspiracy. And in a way, I think it allows an artist to talk about these events in a way where they're not bound by history, and they don't have to pretend to be bound by history. So nobody's going to watch this movie like you would watch JFK and say, well, Oliver Stone's making all that stuff up, and then he's just using the facts that he likes. Or even with Parkland, clearly we heard today that the events in the emergency room were not the way that they were depicted in that movie. And that movie clearly sets itself up to be, you know, an historic document. And clearly we found out today it's not.
Exactly. I mean, the film was not a documentary. It was a film. But still, what is the obligation of filmmakers to, you know, hew close to the truth, to hew close to the facts when depicting, you know, a moment that looms so large in our national history as that one does, Mitch?
I would argue that given Bugliosi's book that Parkland was based on, they should stay as close to the historical record as they possibly can. If that's the obligation, especially when you're presenting the film that way. Oliver Stone was pretty clear with JFK to say he was creating a counter-mythology, that he was creating a possible but not positive representation of those events. And it gets really confusing and frustrating. But, you know, it's show business, and it's Hollywood, and Hollywood has always had a sort of tradition of throwing the history book out the window at a certain point and going for the dramatic goods, which is why I think a movie like Winter Kills doesn't have to be bound by the historical record and can actually turn it into a fictional alternative history that still examines a lot of the big themes and ideas that contributed to this desire to see this conspiracy.
So Mitch Bryan's pick for one of his favorite films depicting the events of 50 years ago today, 1979's Winter Kills. Mitch, I sure appreciate you taking some time.
You bet. It's great talking
Thanks
to you.
Again. Bye-bye. Let's go to Jan from Overland Park. Jan, tell us your memories from 50 years ago today.
Well, I had graduated college that summer and was looking forward to my first teaching job. But first, I spent the summer in Europe with a group called People to People. And before we left on that trip, Robert Kennedy came and addressed us. And while we were doing a tour of the White House, we saw JFK land from a helicopter and stride across the lawn. That was pretty exciting. Had our summer, came back. I'm teaching. I had just turned 21 the week before. And one day the principal comes in with a very stern look on his face. I thought, what have I done now? And he said, the president has been shot. We didn't know that it was a mortal wound at that moment, but I was ready to go actually take a train to Chicago. I was going to become a grandmother for a new baby in the a godmother for a new baby in the family. And I did make that trip, although it was really kind of anticlimactic to all the news of the weekend. Came home, and of course we were all glued to the TV, and maybe my deepest memory is of the funeral itself. And I think any of us who saw that picture of little John, that will never be erased from our minds. And this just popped into my head. I was boiling some water for tea, and I was so engrossed in the television that all of a sudden I smelled something. I'd actually burned up the tea kettle getting to turn it off.
Well, Jan, I'm sure glad you called. Thank you for sharing your memories with us that day.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm going to go to Peter Morello. He's a UMKC Communication Studies professor, and he's in Dealey Plaza right now in Dallas as that city once again is forced to face down this very dark moment in its history. Peter, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Steve.
Peter, you're in the plaza. What do you see? What's going on there this morning?
Right now, it's very, very cold, and it's a bit drizzly. There are thousands of people. There's a ceremony going on right to the left of where I'm standing, and there are just all sorts of people. I'm surprised there are people who, younger people, there are international visitors, everybody just commemorating this event. And I could see, I'm very close to the school book depository, and what's striking about this, because it's the first time that I've seen it, how close everything is, how close the depository is to the street, the grassy knoll, and everything else that is seared into anybody's memory who had lived during that time.
Is it crowded there in the plaza, Peter?
The plaza itself is very crowded, and it's hard to move. But just outside if you look further to the perimeter, there are not too many people. But I'd say right now, if I were to guess, probably about 5,000-7,000 people.
I'm guessing that the mood there in the plaza must be pretty somber, pretty quiet. Am I guessing correctly there, Peter?
Yes. I would say people are very respectful. They're playing bagpipe music right now. I don't know if you can hear it. That's part of the ceremony, and it's really something in how, you know, people are friendly, but also respectful, and you could see just in the eyes of everybody here that everybody is thinking about where they were or what they know of JFK.
We're visiting with Peter Morello, who is a UMKC Communications Studies professor. What's going to happen 30 minutes from now, just about 35 minutes from now, Peter, when the actual moment comes that marks the 50th anniversary of when those shots rang out? Do you have any sense of what's going to happen there in the minutes to come?
I believe there's going to be, and I'm not quite sure, but I believe that there's going to be several moments of silence.
Which only makes sense on a day like today.
Well, and but what I find amazing is that because I was 8 years old when the president was shot, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And to actually be here, especially with people who were born afterward, I think it's a remarkable thing to see what John F. Kennedy's memory has brought out in people. And everybody, I arrived yesterday, and everybody in Dallas has been absolutely hospitable, very hospitable. I talked to a police officer just a little while ago, and there's going to be a ceremony later this evening for J.D. Tibbett, who was a police officer shot by Oswald when he fled. And there's going to be quite a few people there, too, because there's someone else to remember in all of this as well.
Again, Peter Morello is a UMKC Communication Studies professor. He joins us this morning live from Dealey Plaza in Dallas. And, Peter, thank you very much for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve.
You can find more information about all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Monday on the program, raising a child with a physical disability or rearing one who doesn't conform to standard social conventions can change a person profoundly. We'll take a look at the world through the eyes of these parents. We get help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.